This is Mae Breslin, Carmel, California. It's tape number 379, and this is March the 9th, 1979. I want to share with you on this tape the information I have for my book that I waited a long time to receive. I first learned about it in 1978 and discussed on tape number 346. That was in August of 78. The book is called Treason for My Daily Bread. There was one review of the book in The Guardian, and I never heard anything more about it. It was put out by Valency Press in London and was reviewed in June of 77. And this book has made the allegations that the Nazis, specifically Martin Bormann of the Bormann Brotherhood, are behind or were behind the killing of John Kennedy and would be behind the killing of other leaders in this country and around the world. And I wanted the information from that book because of the extensive work I'd done on the Kennedy assassination and the Nazi connections. A friend of mine went to London over the Christmas holidays, and I promised on an earlier tape we'd get to it, but we were busy with the subjects of Jonestown and John Paisley's death and the Rockefeller death. And now I want to get to this book because I think it's important, and it may be a piece of the puzzle that we've been looking for a long time. I completed it and took a lot of notes, and I'll share some of those with you. Whenever I read a book on the John Kennedy assassination, I read it with two eyes, usually. One is critical, to see what is being covered up. Is there disinformation? Are there outright lies? Can you make allowance for ignorance, innocent ignorance, where the author just didn't investigate far enough, but what he did was a good job? And the second thing I look for, of course, is new information. And out of every book, you can pick up some pieces of new information, even if they're trying to divert you from the larger facts. But I look at each book that I have very, very critically, and I have over almost 200 books now critical of the Warren Commission work. I think every book that has been published that I've known about on the John Kennedy assassination, and I take each new book, and the guidelines that I use specifically have to do with the past pieces that were published, articles and books, unpublished manuscripts, and also my extensive 8 years of cross-filing the Warren Commission hearings, the testimony and the evidence that came before the Warren Commission that's in the 26 volumes. I have to admit that I was prejudiced when I began reading this book. I think we come to each book either knowing you're going to hate it or like it, with a certain knowledge of what it's about. And there were so many links of the Nazis to the John Kennedy assassination that I was very anxious to get this book, and so I was looking in some ways, I try to be objective, but with keeping my mind open, seeing what more information Mr. Lebedev has on the assassination of John Kennedy that links to the Nazis. A few of the links to the Nazis that I just briefly will run off the names for you, they may not mean to you very much when I run them off, but they were important links of Lee Harvey Oswald and the Warren Commission to Adolf Hitler's Nazis. I'm not talking about the Nazi Party in America or that loose-knit group that surfaces with the armbands. I'm talking about the Adolf Hitler organization. And one was Albert Osborne, the man that was on the bus with Oswald going to Mexico, who ran a school for assassins, who could possibly have trained this assassin that Mr. Michael Lebedev is writing about. George de Morenchil, Lee Harvey Oswald's buddy, who was a Nazi spy, apprehended during World War II as a Nazi spy, and the cousin of Baron Rangel, who worked with Hitler's agents. He was part of that Polish Eastern European army group funded by Herbert Hoover that created Adolf Hitler, actually formed Adolf Hitler to fight against the Soviet Union. Ruth Payne and Michael Payne had home base for Lee and Marina Oswald in Irving, Texas, which is next to Dallas and Fort Worth, and Michael Payne worked for Walter Dornberger, the Nazi war criminal who came over with Wernher von Braun, who has close links to the Bormann Brotherhood, and he was director of Bell Aerospace. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, whose Division 5 was involved in the Kennedy assassination, with Permindex, a spy organization, had strong links to Meyer Heydrich and Nazis up to and during World War II. He broke off just before Pearl Harbor, was closely associated with the Nazis just until we were bombed by the Japanese Army. Otto Winnicker from Germany was a historian from the Pentagon who sent men over to write the Warren Report, which I don't know that he specifically was pro-Nazi, but they had a German historian writing the Warren Report. Clay Shaw, a very important link of the assassination New Orleans with David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald, a member of Permandex that funded the assassination teams, had met with Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, and Alan Dulles, and Permandex was a nest of Nazis and members of the Bormann Brotherhood. Clay Shaw's name comes up in the assassination. Jean de Morenschild, the wife of George de Morenschild, her father was the director of Far Eastern Railroad, and there's a book out, I have a reference here for you, The Russian Fascist, that I've done a tape on, and they had strong links from Harbin to Shanghai to use aircraft and Lockheed, and Jean de Morenschild was friend and hostess to Marina Oswald and Lee Oswald, and they took them for medical care and bought things for the baby and gifts and introduced them to the white Russian community that Lebedev writes about in his book. The Lawrence Orloff that he writes about, the Colonel Orloff, the Nazi that he meets in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and also he's a friend of David Ferry's in New Orleans, went to Marina Oswald's home and introduced himself. They both went to see her when Lee was working and began the connections of Marina Oswald with the Dallas-Fort Worth members of the intelligence community, the oil community, and Orloff is mentioned in this book. There are many people mentioned, I've given you a list on the sheet that comes with the tape, that are mentioned in the book, and as far as I'm concerned, the ones that he mentioned do check out to my research, whether or not we can ever locate Zed, and we'll talk about that, who Lebedev claims did the fatal headshot to John Kennedy from behind the fence at the Grassy Knoll. That remains to be seen. I doubt if Zed is alive, but it's an interesting tale, and you have to take the book for what Lebedev is saying he did and how he did it and how this network of the Bormann Brotherhood is centralized and working and how it played an important role in our politics in 1963. This story begins in March 1905, that's 74 years ago, just 74 years ago in March, when Michael Lebedev was born in Russia. The story was written in March 15, 1966, 13 years ago. The manuscript was turned over and completed and given to a publisher from London in Beirut. Lebedev gave it to him at that time. And then it was published 11 years later in March of 1977. The London publisher was vacationing in Beirut. He was sitting by a swimming pool, and a man came up to him and said, "You're a publisher, and my name is Lebedev, and I have a story to tell you, a manuscript." And he put it on him, and it took several years to read it, edit it, and evidently he believed in it, and no American publisher would touch it. And finally, a little-known British publisher accepted it by the name of Valency Press. It was edited by W.G. Stanton, and the book, Treason for My Daily Bread, went from a diary and a manuscript then into book form. I think I'll begin discussing the book by just reading you a page at the conclusion. Before I go more into the book, there's several pages that I think that are important, and I always like to start at the end and see how it ends and then go back and see how it unravels. And I want to read with you because I can't translate it any better than what Michael Lebedev is saying. And this is the man who worked for Martin Bormann and was sent to New Orleans and then to Shreveport to meet Zed, the man who would do the fatal headshot at the fence that killed John Kennedy. He says, "The boy who was born in St. Petersburg on a March day in 1905 became the man who found himself in Dealey Plaza November day 1963 as part of a great machine designed for a single purpose. If my conscience is not overtroubled, it is because I have long come to accept that John Kennedy was not the only victim on that day. Zed and myself and other unknown members of that plot were victims, no less than he. It is no doubt true that I have refused to play my part and died for it, but it would have made no difference. There were more than enough of his fellow countrymen who wished John Kennedy ill and who would readily have filled the space that I left. Not only tyrants suffer assassinations, and I am sure he knew his danger when Kennedy went to Dallas, It might be said with more than a little truth that he is the only man who comes out well of the whole miserable business. If anyone should search their own consciences, it is his own countrymen. I might interrupt here to say that I think he's absolutely right. The entire cabinet of Schlesinger, Salinger, his own brother Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, the family, the wife, the press, the media, nobody comes out clean in this thing. They're all dirty and they all covered it up. And he says that Kennedy may be the only man who comes out of the whole miserable business right. And you should search your own consciousness and look at your own countrymen. If those who contrive to kill him are to be found, they must not be looked for in the sleazier parts of New Orleans or Miami or Chicago, for these men were only the instruments of the assassination. I may interrupt again here to say Chicago, because Zed had, he infers, had part of the assignment of killing John Kennedy in Chicago also, and left the Windy City, and sorry that he didn't stay up there. There were plans to kill John Kennedy November the 1st, 1963, but it was called off because of the murder of Diem in Southeast Asia. Kennedy didn't come to Chicago at the time. But Lebedev seems to know about Chicago, and he says, don't look in the sleazy parts of New Orleans or Miami or Chicago, because these men were only the instruments of the assassination. The men who wielded those instruments must be sought in the seats of big business, of influence, of economic and political power, the men who never paid taxes to the country which gave them their wealth. They were the men whom Kennedy threatened, and they were the men who struck him down for his presumption. Now, the group that never paid taxes, that gets a tax write-off on the oil depletion allowance, that pump oil in Venezuela and Middle East and so forth, and invest their profits overseas so they won't have to pay taxes here, are companies like the Exxon, Standard Oil, Mobil Oil. There was the Humble Oil in Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Getty people, the Onassis Oil involvement in this assassination, the Howard Hughes involvement in the assassination, the Hughes oil bit, the bit that helped dig oil for all these oil men, and H.L. Hunt, the oil combines, and Mr. Richardson and the John Connolly connections in Dallas-Fort Worth, and Mr. Murchison, Gulf Oil, as I say, Mobil Oil. All the oil companies had a piece of the action in the Kennedy assassination, and he seems to be saying this because he's talking about those people that got wealth and were threatened because Kennedy seemed to want to be taxing their money. This is what he's implying, that they made profits over material. They never paid taxes to the country for their wealth. Lebedev says the assassination was a crime, but not the greatest crime. There's a greater, and that is that the men who committed it still walk the world. They still pick off instruments one by one to destroy them, still pull the strings which work the puppet politicians. They still amass the wealth which represents the blood and sweat of their fellow countrymen and half a world besides. They will never be brought to justice so long as those whom they exploit worship the same idols and continue to be seduced by the false doctrine that has replaced life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness with wealth, status, and the pursuit of power. Now that translated means as long as you worship money, as long as you worship rich people and you're afraid to touch them, as long as you worship the security that you have by just idolizing these people and trying to emulate them, then the assassins will be walking around the world and exploiting them because you have made them your idols instead of examining them. And that's what gives them the power to exploit and to be the assassins. I wrote something similar to that in 1972 in my first published article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? The section, American Assassins Are Mutations. And I said that when the TV cameras turn their lenses away from the crowd or the hired man who is photographed holding the weapon and the wide view screen, and they turn away, they will see the chambers of Washington, New York, and Montreal, where the real American assassins shall be properly identified. And I wrote at the time that the assassins were agents of the Galen Organization, financed by the CIA through Alan Dulles, that involved Eastern European Russians and Germans, a spy organization that incorporated the Nazis Adolf Hitler's teams, and that this was a network for the assassination teams, and they were found in the boardrooms in Washington, New York, and Montreal. I'm going to continue with the conclusion of his book, and then we'll go to the middle part, the beginning, middle, and the way the book structures it itself. In the end, he says, this manuscript was completed the 15th day of March, 1966, 2 weeks after my 61st birthday in the town of Beirut. My memory is a book that few would like to open and read, or else they would close it forever. If the story ever sees the light of day, if it could point the finger without fear of contradiction at the men behind the assassination of John Kennedy, then indeed my days would be quickly numbered. And for that reason, I find it hard to explain why I have gone to the trouble of telling the story at all. But I grow more conscious with every day that my death really is an end, and that the story dies with me. That man is not important, but the story deserves to be told. I want to be able to say that I know who were the men of that great conspiracy, but I don't think that now they ever will be named. I believe they are men who are well known in high places in that turbulent country. But their treason succeeded, and when that happens, there are few who will dare name the traitors. What I do know, and I'm told by many Americans, is that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the man behind the gun that blew off the skull of John Kennedy. I cannot prove it, but I believe the finger on the trigger was Zed's. He was standing with Zed, and Zed fired, and Zed was wearing a radio control, and he could hear other shots at the time he fired. But Zed did the shot from the fence, and he believes that that was the fatal headshot. This was in 1966, long before the second committee got going. He said, had Oswald survived and his murderer, Jack Ruby, there is a faint hope the truth could have emerged, but that hope is only faint. Those men who organized the plot have made it only too clear to anyone who thinks to speak that the wiser part was silence. Since my return from that country, I have read eagerly every word about the assassination on which I could lay hands. It seems the event was a predictable phenomenon in a land where crimes to be reprehensible only if it's petty and if it fails. I have no illusions about the communist philosophy. Incidentally, Michael Lebedev spent 15 years in a communist camp in Siberia. We'll go into that. He didn't have his documentation when he was sent into Russia, and he was kept in prison for 15 years. So he has a lot of experience with the courts in Russia, more than any of us would ever hope to have. And he says this, he said, I have no illusions about the communist philosophy, nor have I any about the philosophy of capitalism, which seems to me to reach its lunatic peak in the United States. Organized business in that country is not at all unlike organized crime in its doctrine and practice. The fact that the capitalist philosophy has taken overtones of sanctity, enshrined in phrases like private enterprise, ought not to blind uncommitted men to the truth that there is no enterprise quite so private as crime, and that the killing of John Kennedy was merely private enterprise on a grand scale. The saddening truth for America is that the men who contrived to murder their president, his own countrymen, managed to conceal their identity. I believe they were known to one man, and that he, from wrong-headed motives, decided that the truth had best not be known. So he hid the truth, which he should have revealed, and will no doubt go to his grave with his lips sealed. Now, I don't know whether he's referring to J. Edgar Hoover, who he talks about later in future sentences, or whether he means Alan Dulles. He goes on, no impartial man, even without the knowledge I possess, accepts the Warren Commission as the truth about the assassination, nor do I believe the American people pin their hopes on discovering the truth when the evidence which was hidden there is finally taken from the archives after a 50-year sleep. Actually, it was 75. The evidence which really matters, the questions which should have been asked, were not, will die with the men who should have given it, and the guiltiest men of all will soon, in the natural course of things, be beyond reach of question. I believe this one man knew of the conspiracy and had more than an idea who was behind it, but he had long shirked the task of confronting organized crime in his country. And that's J. Edgar Hoover, who worked with Interpol and Meyer Heydrich and the top Nazis, vice president of Interpol, the Nazi organization. He long shirked the task of confronting organized crime and was totally unprepared to deal with its logical outcome in the presidential assassination. Rather than face the real monster, which the American system had spawned, he had busied himself tilting the windmills of communist organizations in his country. And when the monster struck in a quite predictable way, he looked for another windmill, with the conspirators supplying the shape of Lee Harvey Oswald as their patsy. They almost failed even then. They clearly intended that the body of Oswald should be delivered up riddled with police bullets, with all the needful evidence upon his person. But the police were ham-fisted. They fouled up the killing of Officer Tippett. They fouled up the comic Oswald arrest. They fouled up the switching of rifles in the book depository. Besides that, Oswald was a terrible shot. Indeed, so many grievous mistakes were made after the event that only the most rigorous whitewashing could prevent the truth from coming out, as it so nearly did. But they had considerable help in their effort to suppress the truth. They were assisted, for all the wrong reasons, by the man placed to suppress it, the man whose crusade against communism had left his country defenseless against a greater enemy within. That man, he says, was J. Edgar Hoover. There is no concrete proof of that accusation, and I suspect there may never be. This was in 1966 he wrote this, and I think there is concrete proof today of J. Edgar Hoover's role with the Warren Commission, but he didn't have that in 1966. He said no detached observer could study the actions of the FBI after the assassination without coming to the conclusion that their first efforts to discover the truth quickly changed to more desperate efforts to hide it. The Warren Commission was given an impossible task, the task of finding the truth while the vital evidence was concealed from them or distorted. You know how many times I've talked about the evidence being removed, the rifle that didn't have the handprints of Lee Harvey Oswald, the car that was sent to Michigan, the street sign at Dealey Plaza, the lamppost, the CIA papers of Oswald that were missing, the clothing of John Connally that was dry cleaned, the autopsy x-rays of John Kennedy, the bullet proof that there might have been two different bullets fired at John Kennedy's head, the brains missing, about 35 pieces of hard evidence that the Warren Commission had concealed from them, but they didn't demand it. See, they were in collusion, but he says they tried to do the impossible with all the vital evidence concealed from them. So at the end of the day, it was not the evidence which convinced them that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. It was J. Edgar Hoover, and also, I might Earl Warren. He said, the irony of the situation is that he still believes he chose the best course for his country. He is not the only crime committed. His is not the only crime committed in the name of patriotism. The assassination is not the first, nor will it be the last, in America's history, and in the course of time it will shrink to its true historic stature. But for that country, the implications are more vital than the central event. No impartial student of history can doubt that on the 22nd of November 1963, the rot set in for America. The men who engineered the event, with almost limitless sources of wealth to back them, and the power which gave them that wealth, have had the power enhanced by their success. The question for the unhappy land, no less than for my own, is whether people can find some way to take the power back from the man, from the hands of the men who possess it. The future of the world may depend upon the answer to that question. That was written by Michael Lebedev in 1966. In March of 66, he completed that manuscript. In 1968, at the time of the elections, of course, Robert Kennedy was killed. In 1969, Mary Jo Kopechne was murdered, and Ted Kennedy then couldn't run for the 72 elections. In 1972, we had the Wallace shooting, George Wallace shooting, then he couldn't run against Richard Nixon. And in November 1978, we had the Rockefeller death, and no more conflicts on the floor of the Republican Party in 1980 for that election. so much for that. This is the belief of Levadov, and I believe that that is why he wrote the book and even risked his life in Beirut to have you know some of the story, as much as he knew of the story, working on a need-to-know basis. The book is written in, I would say, 10 parts, and as much as time allows on the rest of this side of the tape and the next side of the tape, I'll go into some of the details of how he got into the assassination and ended up in Dealey Plaza, November 22nd, 1963. The first part of the book is the story of his early childhood in Russia. He had a Russian mother, a father who died, evidently a hero in the Soviet Revolution. His father died in 1905. There were strikes of Soviet workers against the Tsar, and 2 months before Michael Levadov was born, his father died, but he was a patriot for the Soviets. And then his mother also died, and he was moved to Germany. The second part of the book is his life in Germany, where he was raised as a child and went to a private school. And a friend of his father's and a teacher by the name of Albrecht befriended him. And he gave him a letter which had to do with his father's revolutionary activity in the Soviet Union, so that in case he ever went back to Russia, he could use it to prove that he was the son of this man who was a hero in those strikes, evidently in 1905. And that this letter would serve him in case the Russian police ever got him, because his father was known in Minsk and where they lived before Levadov had gone to Germany. When he was a young adult, he went back to the Soviet Union, his hometown, and wanted to live there where his mother and father had lived under the Soviet system. And he immediately was put into a spy school. They recognized he had some papers and a letter, and he was put into a spy school where he had intensive 5-year training in the German language and was going to be sent back to Germany as a spy for the Soviet Union. They already had a spy high up in Hitler's camp, many Russian spies, and they had one working with Martin Bormann, the man who was the genius behind Adolf Hitler, running Hitler, really, and later used to set up the Spider, the Odessa, the Bormann Brotherhood, get ready for the Fourth Reich. But Martin Bormann made important decisions on the invasions into Russia, and they needed a spy working high up in the German echelon, and he had lived in Germany as a child, and he had 5 more years of training, and they sent him behind the lines to Germany to work for Martin Bormann, the notorious man behind Adolf Hitler. And being an intelligent person and good skills, Michael Levadov did make up and work his way into the Bormann Adolf Hitler machinery at the very highest level to check on the intelligence that their other agents were giving to see if it was accurate about German intentions to invade Russia. He was still with Martin Bormann the last days in April 1945 when the Russians were coming into Germany, and Martin Bormann was getting ready to flee, and he needed protection. And at that time, instead of Levadov staying in and being acknowledged as a Russian spy, Bormann said to him at that point, "I know you're a Russian spy, and you have to come with me, or you're going to be killed." And it's a cloak and dagger story. It's really a sad story, if this is all true, and I have reason to believe it's true because the characters are consistent with the past research, and it's a sad story. And Martin Bormann says, "Okay, we're going to leave now. We're going to leave Germany, and I need you, because the Russians are coming across the borders," and the Russians went all the way as far as East Berlin. They split up Berlin down the middle. And he said, "I need you by my side so that in case they come to us, you can protect them." And Bormann had another name and a new identity. And in case the Russians swept in, they would have the protection of Levadov, having been a Russian, to cover Martin Bormann's escape. And he said, "Okay, you're going to come with me now. You can't go back to Russia. I need you, and we're going to leave." So they were given papers. This story of the moving to Germany was the second part of the book, and then moving back, moving to Russia, rather, was the second part of the book, and then moving to Germany with Bormann was the third big part of the book. And then the fourth is when the Russians come into Germany and the escape of Levadov and Bormann and how they get down to South America, to Paraguay, and successfully escape. They're disguised as missionaries, and they wear the cloak of monks, and they're put in an Italian missionary, which confirms the stories of Ferrago of the escape of Bormann getting out in the Vatican, writing his passports and his papers. Lebedev and Bormann had impeccable papers when it was time to leave, and by November 1945, they were ready to leave Italy. We'll do some more of that story on the other side of this tape now.